Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized tonight's event as part of our Monday Night Philosophy Series. I'd like to welcome our audience live here in San Francisco and our radio and online audiences. And it's my pleasure to introduce Professor Lanier Anderson from Stanford. He is an associate professor in the Department of Philosophy. He is also a teacher in the freshman program on philosophy and literature. And therefore, you'll get a little idea about how freshmen at Stanford are introduced to both philosophy and literature. Professor Lanier Anderson.
Thank you very much, George. It's a great honor to be here, and I'm very, very happy to have been invited. I can't quite see you, so I'm going to use the step. Because I'm a short guy. Much better. All right. I'm also getting to be an old guy, so I can't really quite see my talk unless I get a little further away. My starting point tonight is the finitude of the human condition. Of course, mortality is a fundamental fact for us, but the issue is farther reaching than that. The combination of our carings and our basic finitude in power leave us inevitably, ineluctably vulnerable to all kinds of losses and setbacks. So we face a basic problem about how to manage in the face of calamities, whether personal or social, accidental or self-inflicted by our own actions. Philosophies and religions have long sought to grapple with this condition, and I'll be paying special attention tonight to the Christian notion of redemption and its limitations. But the first point I want to emphasize is just the ubiquity of the problem that a notion like redemption aims to address. We all of us suffer losses, and the impulse somehow to restore value to our lives in their aftermath is powerful and fundamental. So that's the first point. One broad strategy for coping with our vulnerability in this dimension is to seek some perspective that would enable us to step back and see our lives whole. Not only can this direct attention away from the particular trauma, which, to quote one of my authors for tonight, might otherwise threaten to make what is closest at hand and most vulgar appear as if it were vast and reality itself, but further, it promises to set the immediate loss in a wider context of life overall and simultaneously reduce its importance and highlight other sources of value in our lives that might offset it. Nietzsche and Kundera were interested in a particular version of this strategy, which begins from a thought experiment proposed by Nietzsche. But the two writers use that idea in different ways. As a philosopher, Nietzsche takes a practically minded approach. That's intended to be a little provocative. As a philosopher, Nietzsche takes a practically minded approach. For him, this thought experiment was a kind of diagnostic test for determining whether our life needs redeeming in the first place. And in addition, he thought that this idea could put its finger right on the hurt place in our life in a way that provided a kind of practical guide for redeeming the loss. In fact, his main objection against the Christian conception of redemption, for which he had a keen understanding in his capacity as a preacher's kid, was that he thought this idea failed to identify, the Christian idea failed to identify the right target for redemptive attention and also failed to provide the right kind of practical advice. By contrast, Nietzsche holds that, this is a quote from him, Kundera holds, by contrast to Nietzsche, that the novel spirit is the spirit of complexity. Every novel says to the reader, things are not as simple as you think. That's the novel's eternal truth, but it grows steadily harder to hear amid the din of easy, quick answers nowadays. From that point of view, the last thing that a writer should offer is practical advice or any kind of lesson. And yet, Kundera repeatedly returns to Nietzsche's thought experiment precisely because it provokes a kind of global consideration of a person's life, especially in moments of loss or crisis or decision. By throwing his characters into these thoughts, Kundera aims to promote a spirit of reflective self-assessment that's capable of revealing the complexities that the quick, easy self-help answers of our day are conspiring to cover up. For that reason, the Nietzschean thought experiment, which was designed to force us to see our life whole, suits his purposes. I'll suggest that he uses it to to reveal the different temporal dimensions, past, present, and future, from which life's problems confront us. True to his principles, though, he refuses to say what it would take for his characters to attain redemption. He wants to provoke us to think it through. So in the end, I'll come back to the contrast between Nietzsche and Christianity as a way of framing our follow-on discussion about the issue. So I'll turn first to some discussion of Nietzsche and his idea of eternal recurrence of the same. The thought experiment I want to investigate from Nietzsche was very apt for Kundera's purposes because it highlights the temporal structure of the problem of redemption. That problem arises when something has happened in the past that flouts some values that we care about in a way that leaves us in a state of loss in the present, posing a problem for the future about what can be made of our lives now. The thought experiment through which Nietzsche raises these issues concerns what he called the eternal recurrence of the same. And his proposal about how to redeem the past rests on a certain kind of integration of past, present, and future through a unifying narrative life story. Nietzsche saw this idea about eternal recurrence as his most important thought, and while it's often been read as a big, ambitious cosmological theory about how time itself runs in a giant circle, I think that's BS, and recent commentators have shown that the thought was really intended instead as a thought experiment designed to assess the value of life. Nietzsche asks us not to believe that everything recurs, but instead to imagine that our lives will return, and our reaction to that thought experiment is supposed to show something about how good they are, much as it might when you're pressed by your spouse to know whether you would still want to marry if you had it to do all over again, as we say. A reaction of joy will indicate that the life is good, whereas sorrow or regret show that it will have been wanting. And also notice that if you then divert the question by indulging in metaphysical speculations about whether it's really coherent that the whole thing is coming back and whether time really is running in a circle, your wife will have her answer. She will know. So the thought experiment, because joy indicates that the life is good and sorrow or regret indicates that it's bad, the thought experiment implicitly posits life affirmation as a kind of ideal. And here's a text that I'll read out where Nietzsche first introduced the idea. It's in the Gay Science, and the section is called The Greatest Weight. He writes there, "What if some day or night a demon were to steal after you into your loneliest loneliness and say to you, this life as you now live it and have lived it, you'll have to live once more and innumerable times more, and there'll be nothing new in it, but every pain and every pleasure and every thought and everything unutterably small or great in your life will have to return to you, all in the same succession and sequence. Wouldn't you throw yourself down and gnash your teeth? Or have you once experienced a tremendous moment when you would have answered, you're a god, and I've never heard anything so divine? If this thought gained dominion over you, it would change you as you are or maybe crush you. The question in each and everything, do you desire this once more and innumerable times more, would lie upon your actions as the greatest weight. How well disposed would you have to become to yourself and to life to wish for nothing more than this eternal confirmation and seal?" So that's what he says. He's a good writer. So the first thing to note about the demon's challenge is that it fixes us within a practical point of view for assessing the value of life. You're supposed to imagine that this life, as you've now lived it and have lived it, will come back to you innumerable more times, and then evaluate your reactions. Nietzsche doesn't say anything about the standards that you should use to make this assessment, so they must be just the ones that you yourself endorsed. Those are the ones that will be manifested and activated in your reaction. The thought experiment thus becomes a kind of consistency or coherence test that reveals how consonant the person's life is with the values that she really endorses. Now, there are a lot of questions about the plausibility and about the proper interpretation of this idea, but I don't want to raise all those. I just want to focus on a few ideas that are connected to our theme of redemption. First, for Nietzsche, the response of life affirmation will turn out to be a criterion for successful redemption, and we should try to understand why. So that's what I'll devote most of my Second, this attitude of affirmation is directed in the first instance toward the events of our past, but it also turns out to exploit our attitude toward the future in a distinctive way. These appeals to our attitudes about the past and about the future will turn out to mark an important contrast between Nietzsche's view and the temporal logic built into the Christian idea of redemption, and that's one of the things I'll explore. Finally, it's worth asking how affirmation of this sort could change you as you are, as the passage insists that it will. The kind of change that turns out to be involved is crucial to the distinctive form of redemption that Nietzsche proposes as a replacement for the Christian idea. I'll return to that point at the end. Three temporal ideas are built right into the thought experiment from the beginning. We're supposed to imagine a recurrence that's eternal and applies to the very same life that we already had. So first, in imagining my life to recur, I project the whole of it out into my future. That's crucial to the way the experiment itself works because our natural practical attitudes toward the past and the future show a marked asymmetry. We normally see the past as something beyond our control, and for just that reason, not a proper object of our practical cares. While we do sometimes adopt practical attitudes toward the past, like regret, they have a secondary status compared to future-directed attitudes like hope and anxiety, at least when it comes to our practical life. The idea of recurrence is intended to counter that natural asymmetry. The thought is that we should sharpen and rationalize the self-assessment that the thought experiment is going to produce, get us to see our lives as a whole by blocking this tendency to prioritize the future over the past and ignore the past. Under the influence of the normal asymmetry, we're often tempted to just abandon the past as if it doesn't really concern us anymore. That might be useful for certain contexts of future-oriented action, but if what you want is a cold, clear-eyed assessment of whether your life has been good, the past can be disregarded only at the cost of self-deception. Its being past, after all, in no way removes it from your life, from the life itself. And that fact is made manifest by this thought of recurrence that puts it back out there in the future. By projecting my entire life imaginatively into the future, the thought induces me to consider the whole of it with the same motivated, that is, hopeful or anxious concern that I normally reserve for just my future. The fact that the imagined recurrence is eternal, that's the second thing, enhances the same effect. For under that assumption, I can never look forward to a time when I could pretend to be thoroughly finished with the thing. I'm supposed to imagine, remember, that it's coming back again and again. Here, Nietzsche begins to contest the temporal structure of the Christian notion of redemption. For Nietzsche, the acceptance of life events under the restricting condition that they're merely past would not count as life affirmation. But that's exactly what the Christian notion wants us to do. The prospect of salvation might make our present life in sin here seem acceptable, but only because that life is to be relegated to the past and compensated by a later redemption in which we're going to be delivered from sin and moral order in the world is restored. In consequence, the Christian promise valorizes a permanent, unchanging, blessed state that puts an end to all earthly troubles, and Christian redemption is fundamentally about compensating a person for the bad things she's endured. Our sin is supposed to be paid for, remember, and the Christian concept emphasizes this etymological sense of redemption as a compensating ransom payment of some sort. Originally, one redeemed a person out of bondage or slavery or something like that, and this was the original religious context of redemption too in the Old Testament. But if we had to descend into sin all over again, as envisioned by an eternal recurrence, salvation would be deprived of this compensatory value. After all, what compensated us for tribulation was never simply that the measure of bliss in heaven was sort of heavier and outweighed the measure of our suffering, but but instead that suffering was supposed to undergo some final defeat. To feel the force of the point, imagine that you're an unhappy gambler, and the casino comes and offers to pay you back all the losses that you've suffered so far, but only on the condition that you stay in the casino, stay at the table, staking the payment they give you in a game in which the odds are stacked all against you. That's not, that kind of repayment is not compensation for your losses. On the contrary, that's continued torment. So the final defeat of sin turns out to be essential to the Christian redemption. And the real function of the eternity of paradise in the Christian conception is not its bare permanence, but a consequence of that permanence, namely that our future-oriented practical concern is going to be relieved of all further worry. A radical rupture of temporal continuity is thereby built into the Christian idea of redemption, which removes our salvation to a new and temporally discontinuous order. Nietzsche's underlying objection against Christian redemption begins right there. The Christian thought tries to reduce or even eliminate the practical importance of my past to make it something that has as little as possible to do with me. In a sense, then, what it promises is not the redemption of my life, but a redemption from my life. Christianly understood, our present condition is radically divorced from our true spiritual destiny. The idyllic future state is not merely separated from us by a long time. On the contrary, it exists in a completely different history, removed from us by this complete rupture. The thought of eternal recurrence contests the Christian conception by smoothing over that rupture, putting my past back into my future, and enforcing the idea that my past really matters to the question of whether my life is good. In Nietzsche's thought experiment, the appeal to eternity doesn't break the temporal continuity of my life, since what's eternal here is not some separate atemporal condition, but the repeated return of the same fluctuating pattern of developments that constitute my life. The salience of the past is reinforced by that third idea from the thought experiment that I mentioned, the demand that what returns is my very same life. Remember, every thought, every pain, every pleasure, every sigh, every thought, unutterable, small, blah, blah, blah. Nietzsche insists that my past is just the life I have, the very one that needs redeeming. The sameness of the recurring life controls the content and the implications of the resulting wished-for life affirmation. After all, if the life that I imagine to recur, if I could sort of rig the game so that I could just omit from the life that's imagined to recur all the events that happened to me that seemed to be problematic from the point of view of my values, then it would be easy to get this alleged harmony between my life and values. But that's not real harmony. So if affirmation is going to count as a genuine test of harmony between the life I really had and the values that I have, then the sameness criterion is essential. I have to, as it were, glue myself to my life by including every single one of its events in the imagined recurring sequence. In that case, affirmation will take the form of a wholehearted endorsement of the life that I've actually had. So Nietzsche's criticism of the Christian view is that it has identified the wrong target for redemption. It ransoms me from my very own life and then offers to pay me back for its evil. But what really needed redeeming was the real life I actually lived, not some version of me that was somehow separated from that life by this radical temporal rupture and then results in some kind of payback for me, some compensation. But of course, and now recall my opening point about the ubiquity of our vulnerability, of course nobody has a life that's free of any regrettable feature. So how could anyone will the recurrence of her life under the condition that it has to be the same in every last detail? It's exactly here that the question of redemption becomes pressing. How can we redeem those regrettable aspects of life, especially if we're renouncing any hope of compensation in the Christian mold? The broad strategy for redemption, remember, was an assumption that it'll somehow help to see your life whole. As Nietzsche once put it, we should try to create and carry into one what is fragment and riddle and dreadful accident, to recreate all it was into a thus I willed it. That alone, he said, what I call redemption. The suggestion is that fragmentary, accidental, regrettable aspects of life can be redeemed by being first carried into one and then willed, brought into some whole that the person can then endorse, say yes to. Nietzsche's key strategy for such unification focuses on building narrative continuity for my life. If I could just tell my life story so as to connect my past to a present and a future that allow me to will the whole thing, then I could affirm each one of the events in it because of the essential contribution it makes to the meaning of the whole thing. In that way, events that were considered by themselves regrettable, as he put it, fragment, riddle, dreadful accident, will be, his word, transfigured and can be affirmed nevertheless. That is, the new story of my life affords a new context for these fragments, which changes their significance and so redeems them, and I thereby bring my life into greater harmony with my values and improve it in the dimension that Nietzsche was concerned about. So that's all pretty abstract. In some papers about Nietzsche, I've tried to capture this idea through an example. One of the papers was actually invited for a volume by Joshua Landy, so I hereby thank him for helping me to develop the ideas. So here's an example that I tried to work out in some of those papers. It has to do with the career of Jimmy Carter, former president of our country, whose crushing 1980 defeat at the hands of that actor, Ronald Reagan, sharply poses the problem of redemption. Carter's defeat, after all, was a sweeping repudiation of his core values and accomplishments, and it ended all of his ongoing projects. But worst of all, it essentially marked the end of his public career and defined that career as a failure. Back then, after all, the main activity of ex-presidents was golf. Those people are finished, man, finished. So Carter needed to redeem his defeat to turn it from a debilitating setback into something that could be accepted. His response is well known. He transformed the presidential library that they all have into the Carter Center, thereby mounting a new project that allowed him to do work in dispute resolution, disease eradication, poverty alleviation, and on, that was rewarding for him and important for the world. In the event, he attained a credibility as a moral leader that no other 20th century ex-president approached. Leadership ultimately recognized quite broadly, culminating in the 2002 Nobel Peace Prize. It's by now a commonplace that Carter built the greatest U.S. ex-presidency, and also that that ex-presidency and not the original presidency was his true calling as a public figure. The crucial point about this example is that it's highly unlikely that the Carter ex-presidency would have been so accomplished had he won re-election in 1980. His activities have gone so far beyond the normal course of what we call elder statesman politics that it's hard to imagine his even conceiving the project without the need for redemption posed by that stinging defeat. In that sense, to endorse this ex-presidency is also to endorse the defeat, and precisely that fact allows the later successes to redeem the earlier failure by making the earlier failure something that can be willed. To wish away the defeat, after all, would be to wish away Carter's achievement, namely the invention of a whole new kind of public life along with the achievement of all those concrete accomplishments that went along to making it up. So we can now see the connection between life affirmation and redemption. One affirms one's life if one can wholeheartedly endorse it, complete with setbacks as well as triumphs. Such endorsement is convincing if the person herself is happy at the prospect that this self-same life would return to her. That kind of affirmation will clearly require the redemption of some aspects, since every life contains its dreadful accidents, as Nietzsche put it. But arguably, Carter could affirm his life in that sense. Notice, he's not redeemed here by being compensated for his loss or by having his real life, which includes the catastrophic setback, removed from him and replaced by paradise. On the contrary, if we think of his achievement in light of the recurrence idea, the place of that 1980 defeat within his life story is dramatically reinforced. From the new point of view, it's now the hinge around which his entire public life turns. Notice that even after his new life narrative is conceived, the affirmability of setbacks doesn't emerge simply as a matter of his coming to look at the life a new way, his having dreamed up the new life story. To get redeemed, Carter actually had to do something to positively change the meaning of his life, from the story of a failed political career into this narrative of moral leadership. If he never did anything with the Carter Center, nothing would have gotten redeemed. He had to make those concrete contributions that turned the newly imagined story into a true story. That provides the practical upshot that I claimed for Nietzsche's thought experiment, highlighting how affirmation can change who you are, change you as you are, as the quote put it. Instead of encouraging the thought that we would redeem ourselves by getting rid of the crappy life we've led in this mortal coil in favor of an entirely different mode of existence in paradise, the thought of recurrence instead focuses the mind relentlessly on exactly the places in our life story where the shoe pinches. And we have to imagine those very places returning again and again and again. Those are the targets of our transfiguring redemptive activity. Nietzsche's recommendation here is to devise and then live out a new continuation to the story of our life, in light of which those moments of loss will turn out to have a different, more affirmable meaning than they seemed to when they were happening. If we pull off that kind of transfiguration, then we would honestly be able to say that we turned that formerly immovable "it was" into a "thus I willed it." So that's all I'm going to say about Nietzsche for a moment. Let me turn now to the Franco-Czech novelist Milan Kundera, who is an incredibly insightful reader of Nietzsche. And his exploration of the eternal recurrence as a thought experiment in the 1984 novel Unbearable Lightness of Being actually deserves some credit, I think, for helping philosophical commentators come to see that this fundamentally practical idea about a thought experiment for evaluating life is the real problem space for Nietzsche's view. The novel opens with the idea of recurrence. The first line of the novel is, "The idea of eternal return is a mysterious one, and Nietzsche has often perplexed other philosophers with it," which is true. The thought quickly enters the story, too, as a governing conception in the mind of the main character, Tomas. Tomas is a dedicated doctor, but also an insatiable sexual adventurer. On a recent trip to the country, he met a new lover, Teresa, and when she visited him in Prague, she fell ill and had to stay for a whole week. When we meet Tomas for the first time, he's trying to decide whether to invite her back to Prague, knowing more or less clearly that if he does, she'll come, suitcase in tow, and, in his thought, offer him up her life. That would threaten the basic arrangements of his life, which involve numerous mistresses. But he can neither shake this feeling he has of what he calls inexplicable love for Teresa, nor decide whether this inexplicable feeling is truly love declaring itself to him, or instead some kind of, his thought, hysteria. The recurrence thought provides a kind of resolution to the tension here, even though it leaves Tomas himself completely indecisive. What it does is it reconciles him to his bafflement. So here's a quote from the novel. "He remained annoyed with himself until he realized that not knowing what he wanted was actually quite natural. We can never know what to want, because living only once, we can neither compare it with our previous lives nor perfect it in our lives to come. Was it better to be with Teresa or to remain alone? There's no way of testing which decision is better, because there's no basis for comparison. And what can life be worth if the first rehearsal for life is life itself? Einmal ist keinmal," says Tomas to himself. "What happens but once," says the German adage, "might as well not have happened at all." This scene happens right after Kundera has introduced us to Tomas with these words: "I have been thinking about Tomas for many years, but only in light of these reflections about eternal return did I see him clearly for the first time." Kundera's reflections about eternal recurrence emphasize a point that I picked up on in Nietzsche, that our normal practical stance toward life is so future-oriented that the past becomes insignificant. Kundera calls it lighter than feathers. The thought of recurrence is supposed to restore some seriousness and weight to the proceedings, to convince convey that what we do and what happens to us matters. By rejecting that thought, Tomas yanks himself out of his reverie and convinces himself that nothing matters, that he can remain light. In the end, he never does decide whether to invite Teresa. But to his surprise, and actually to his joy, Teresa shows up anyway, deciding the question for him, and from then on, their common life has weight because of her taking things seriously. And so Kundera's opening question for the story is posed. What then shall we choose, weight or lightness? From my opening remarks, you'll guess that Kundera's novel refuses us any answer. Instead, it uses the thought of return to frame various ways of thinking about the question. In Tomas's hands, the experiment is fundamentally future-directed. It appears as a kind of decision procedure. He could reason out what he had to do if only he could compare the two options, the life with Teresa, the life without Teresa, rehearse, and then know which one was best. The thought experiment asks us to do this in imagination. We imagine how we would feel if each course of action recurred, and then we understand the real weight of the options before us. But Tomas short-circuits the procedure by undermining, disabling the imagination. In reality, he says to himself, there is no lifetime rehearsal, so there's no way to know, and anyway, einmal ist keinmal, so it doesn't matter. Kundera doesn't give this type of thinking a complete pass in the novel. On the contrary, just before Tomas indulges in it, the narrator comes to a rather different conclusion, lamenting what he calls the profound moral perversity of a world that rests essentially on the non-existence of recurrence. He's driven to that thought by reflecting that if the past were entirely light, then any amount of horror or evil might fade into insignificance. So here's the line of thought that leads him to that. In the sunset of this dissolution, everything is illuminated by the aura of nostalgia, even the guillotine. Not long ago, I caught myself experiencing a most incredible sensation. Leafing through a book on Hitler, I was touched by some of his portraits. They reminded me of my childhood. I grew up in the war. Several members of my family perished in the camps, but what were their deaths compared to the memories of a lost period of my life, a period that would never return? Hence the profound moral perversity of a world without the weight that recurrence brings to it. Unbearable Lightness goes on to pursue this matter of lightness versus weight, and the whole novel explores that question. But Kundera didn't forget about this intense and somewhat troubling power of nostalgia over us. On the contrary, he went on to write an entire book about that. The novel Ignorance, from 2000, observes that many European words for nostalgia are derived from the Latin term ignorare, and so that suggests that nostalgia is a kind of pain of not knowing. Say, not knowing what's happening back home, something like that. The novel explores the experience of exiles from communist Czechoslovakia who've made their lives in the West during the 20 years between the failure of the Prague Spring and the collapse of communism, comparing these people to Odysseus, who also spent 20 years away from Ithaca. Post-1989, these exiles were suddenly able to return home. So for them, the question of reliving their past is pressing. People around them, both in the West and in Bohemia, expect them to be moved by nostalgia, by the poignancy of making a great return, as he puts it in capital letters. But confronted with the actual prospect, they quickly see the fundamental divide that exile has cut across their pasts. One of those exiles, a character named Irena, invents a chilling metaphor for the feeling. To her, the people she meets back in Prague seem to want to delete the entire 20 years of her life in Paris as if they never happened, as though amputating her arm and then reattaching the hand at the elbow. The most problematic character in Ignorance, Josef, passed his exile in Denmark, and his thoughts about whether to relive his past life by coming back to Bohemia are affected by what the narrator initially diagnoses as a case of nostalgic insufficiency that prevents his feeling the charm of the past that so gripped Kundera himself back in Unbearable Lightness of Being. But pretty soon the narrator revises this view, rejects his initial sense of it. quote, "But Yosef himself does not feel sick. He feels clear-headed. To his mind, the nostalgic insufficiency just proves the paltry value of his former life. So I revise my diagnosis. The patient is suffering from masochistic distortion of memory. Indeed, all he remembers are situations that make him displeased with himself." So here we have a paradigm case where the thought of return exposes just which parts of the life are wanting. Though Kundera doesn't bring up the Nietzschean thought experiment in an explicit way in this context, the device of an actual return to Bohemia similarly forces his character to confront what it would be to relive his past. The test reveals how deeply disaffected he was, and indeed still is, from his old life, and Kundera goes on to explore some of the pathologies of that discontent in the novel. So I won't issue any spoilers here for people who haven't read it, which you definitely should do, but suffice it to say that even though all the things Yosef remembers make him displeased with himself, there are also lots of things he does not remember, indeed still doesn't remember even when he gets documentary evidence of them. And some, although not all, of these zones of ignorance provide further legitimate reasons for discontent with his life. For tonight, I want to focus on a different observation about the Yosef case. Whereas Tomas showed us how the thought of return could focus us on our future life by deploying it as a decision procedure for weighing up courses of action, ignorance instead emphasizes the import of return for our relation to our past. What's interesting about Yosef is that his past falls into two entirely different parts: the life in Czechoslovakia, from which he's deeply alienated and which he certainly would not will again, and then his life in Denmark, to which he's actually eager to return, within which, in fact, he spends basically all his energy in a past-oriented, almost antiquarian and curatorial mode, preserving the symbols of his life with his recently deceased wife. So no nostalgic insufficiency there. From a Nietzschean point of view, the situation is kind of curious. Yosef obviously would be prepared to relive the life in Denmark, but not at all the life in Bohemia. Should we think that Yosef's life in Denmark redeems his youth? If not, what should we make of his willingness to relive the Danish part of the past? What stance should we take toward a life that is, as it were, like this, hived into two? And what does that tell us about Nietzsche's demand for a unifying, overarching narrative, life narrative that would redeem us? Kundera was already interested in nostalgia even before ignorance. We saw it come up in Unbearable Lightness. It also exerts a driving force in what's perhaps his greatest novel, Immortality. That novel opens on a scene in which a novelist named Milan Kundera is sitting by a pool in his health club, watching an older woman take a swimming lesson. Later on, as she leaves, she turns to wave at her instructor with a captivating, incongruously youthful gesture which grips the novelist's imagination, giving rise to his main character, Agnes, and thence to the novel itself. Here's the quote: "Just as Eve came from Adam's rib, just as Venus was born out of the waves, Agnes sprang from the gesture of that 60-year-old woman at the pool who waved at the lifeguard and whose features are already fading from my memory. At that time, the gesture aroused in me an immense, inexplicable nostalgia, and that nostalgia gave birth to the woman I call Agnes." Like Tomas, Agnes ends up considering the thought of recurrence fairly explicitly. She is, she wants us to know, fairly happily married, and she's built a good life for herself in Paris with her husband Paul and daughter Brigitte. Her sister Laura, 8 years younger, is less happy and has troubles in love, but Agnes helps her out and keeps her mostly on track. Still, Agnes craves a kind of solitude that she used to be able to enjoy in her childhood in Switzerland, especially on these long walks through the woods with her mathematician father. Now comes the issue of return. Agnes has this recurring dream or daydream, often it's a daydream, about people who come from another planet or another dimension or something like that, who will take up into their cleaner, freer plane of existence certain people who are not too attached to this all too quick and easy world, a disgust for which she shares with her creator, Milan Kundera. She imagines they're showing up at her apartment, and she knows who they are, but unfortunately they came at a time when her husband Paul was around, and he's clueless. The visitors keep wanting to sit them down in the living room to talk. She keeps trying to divert things and get Paul out of the house, but nothing works, and finally the purpose of the visit comes out. She's rightly guessed the main issue, but they also have a further question. Do the two of them want to remain together in the next life or not? And now the quote. Agnes knew the question was coming. That was the reason she wanted to be alone with the visitor. She knew that in Paul's presence, she would be incapable of saying, "I no longer want to be with him." She could not say it in front of him, nor he in front of her, even though it's probable that he too would prefer to try living the next life differently. Yet saying it aloud to each other's face, that would amount to saying, "No love ever existed between us, and no love exists between us now." And that's precisely what's so impossible to say aloud. But today, for the first time, she was certain that even in Paul's presence, she would find the courage to say what she really wanted. She ran through the whole scene once again. Agnes gathers all her inner strength and answers in a firm voice, "We prefer never to meet again." These words are like the click of a door shutting on the illusion of love. Okay, so I won't, in this case too, I won't issue spoilers, but it's worth emphasizing that in Agnes's mind, her happy marriage is founded on acts of will through which she sustains her love, or maybe if you believe that last line, the illusion of that love. In the end, the novel does manufacture a kind of way for her to leave both Paul and her sister well provided for without breaking their hearts. But what's important for our purposes is a different point, that the thought of return is used here to illuminate a third temporal dimension. In Agnes's case, it sheds a bright light, even a glare, that reveals her present condition, revealing that willing to love is not the same thing as loving. Everything that follows from that. So the quote was, "No love existed between us, and no love exists between us now." From our three characters, therefore, we've learned that the thought of return can be used to shed light on all three dimensions of our temporal existence. It can help determine the weights of future courses of action, or reveal how we feel about the past, or illuminate our present condition. It's a thought experiment that exposes what value really inheres in these three dimensions of our life. Kundera does not assert anything, though, about how these characters might redeem themselves from the difficulties they're in. In that sense, he uses the thought only for the first of the two purposes that Nietzsche had for it, to reveal the evaluative situation of his characters and not to show how they might build new life stories capable of repairing their situations. So a few words in conclusion. What we learned about the question of redemption from the contrast between the Nietzschean and the Christian conceptions, as it seems to me, was something like this. On the Christian conception, the problem of redemption is a question of compensation, and it's fundamentally future-oriented. What future, the question is, could pay a person back for the losses that she suffered? How can the person be taken out of her damaged life and saved in a new, purified future life? By contrast, Nietzsche insisted that what really needs redeeming is not the person separate from her life, but the damaged life itself. For him, some important weight always remains on the past, on the it was. And a real redemption, genuine redemption, has to occur within this life, remaining temporally continuous with the loss that needed redeeming in the first place. Redemption, therefore, happens through realizing a new life story that changes the meaning of one's setbacks into something affirmable. And here, redemption's not a matter of compensation, but what I called before transfiguration, a kind of metamorphosis that transforms the bad moments from something ruinous into something affirmable, at least within the new context, the context of the whole. Nietzsche's basic criticism of the compensation model is that so far from reconciling me to myself, which you might think redemption ought to do, the promise of compensation threatens actually to reinforce an attitude of self-condemnation. After all, I demand compensation exactly insofar as, by my own lights, my life is bad. In that sense, the compensation picture encourages me to get rid of my life, generating a final worry that even if I go for it, even if I get the compensation, I will not be redeemed after all. What I needed was to heal my broken life, not to acquire some other life radically distinct from the one I have now. On reflection, the postulated identity between the recipient of such payments, let's call that guy heavenly Lanier, and me, the earthly Lanier, is open to serious question. The complete difference between his life and my life militates against any such identity, and if we're not the same, then the heavenly Lanier's bounty doesn't even count as recompense for my losses. By focusing our attention on all three temporal dimensions of the recurring life, the past and the present, and not just the future, Kundera seems to be siding with Nietzsche on this question. He directs our attention to the temporal continuity of our life in the here and now by focusing us on these three dimensions. But of course, he never says so. He leaves that question for us. And that's reason enough for me to stop talking and open the question out to you all. Thank you.
I'd like to remind the audience that we're listening to What Is It to Redeem Your Past? Some Lessons from Nietzsche and Kundera, Professor Lanier Anderson. And now it's time for questions. And I would like to say one thing. Please don't repeat your questions too many times in a row.
Yeah, hi. Thanks, Professor. I would like to ask you to return to the central portion of your essay discussing Jimmy Carter.
Right.
And I would argue that, like you, well, perhaps, I'm a big fan of him as an ex-president.
Right.
And I would argue that his post-presidency life was more of an expression of his true personality than redemption for failure as president. Your thoughts?
Right. So part of the reason this example works for me is that Jimmy and Rosalynn Carter actually wrote a book called Everything to Gain in the mid-1980s. And it really was about how they were trying to rebuild their life together after the failure of his presidency. And the failure actually went quite far. So I focused on the failure of the presidency itself and the repudiation in the election. But there were other things, too. So he was a very successful businessman before he went into politics. But while he was in politics, he put all of his assets in a blind trust, and the trustees totally screwed everything up, and he lost his business. So he was ruined, and he's financially ruined, and his political career looked like a failure, and really looked quite grim for him. And I think another important feature of it to remember is that unlike the recently passed presidents, Jimmy Carter was still quite a young man when this happened. And really would have been expected, if he had had a normal career path, to have 15 or 20 more years of professional activity. And he really was at loose ends. He had a lot of energy left, and he felt very bad about having nowhere to deploy it. And so there's a remarkable scene in the book where Rosalynn wakes up in the middle of the night. It's a co-authored book, and so this part is written in her voice. She wakes up in the middle of the night and says, "What's wrong, Jimmy? What's wrong?" He's been sitting there stock upright in bed for hours, and she says, "Is something wrong? Are you sick? Or, what's wrong?" And he says, no, "I figured out what I'm going to do. I figured out what to do with the library. I'm going to turn it into this center, and we're going to solve disputes there." And that was the beginning of his turning the rest of his life around. So I think his own way of thinking about it really did have this structure. He felt the need to do something with his life that would remove the sting of failure from the main projects that he had. And now, to go back to the main point that you made, I think that he's a pretty wise guy, and he chose wisely in this case. And your question really brought out the sense in which he chose wisely. So you said something like, the ex-presidency he built was the real reflection of his personality, not the political career. I think he came to see that about himself, and that fact, the fact that it really did reflect something important about his personality, helped this redemptive project turn out to be successful because it had materials in the earlier part of his life to work with, right? There were other things in his earlier life that seemed continuous with the stuff that he ended up doing and then facilitated the interpretation that people like you and I are tempted to put on now, which is that was the real story. And he just needed this crushing feat to show him, which I should admit that of course there are some people who are not great.
Okay. Continuing on with Jimmy Carter, seemed to, if I remember correctly, he had stated he was reborn. And so that means that redemption is when you now redeem yourself and continue the rest of your life, as opposed to going into another life and redeeming at that time. In fact, I don't know that there are any known people who are believable who are walking around and say, this is my second life or third life. And, so it would have to be within your own life.
I wanted to talk not about the afterlife, but also about, you said, reliving your life. So in Christianity, you know, people are living and doing good deeds because they're going to relive in heaven or hell. And in Buddhism, it's karma. Like if you would get a good rebirth if you do good deeds. And I think that's just avoiding the life you have now. Because my Zen teacher, whenever he brings it up, he knows I'm going to say, karma is just you should do the right thing right now. It's not like you're doing it because it's going to get you somewhere.
I think you should be a fan of the third feature of the thought experiment that I
Hi. I'm wondering about if you could talk a little bit about the relationship between memory and clarity of memory and the effectiveness of the thought experiment. So I'm wondering about what happens when one is far removed from the occurrences that will have to recur in order to have the thought experiment be potent in the moment.
Go into this because if you turn it around and say, What about things that were really wonderful in your life and that in a new context you could turn it all around and make it awful as well in the other direction? But I know there's only time for one last question.
All this means that you have to believe in good and evil. And if you don't believe in good and evil, if you just believe that's an evolutionary process, then why even be concerned about all this? I mean, redemption means that you're guilty of something. You're just living your life and evolving in your life. You don't need redemption from anything or anybody. I want to add one other item. What you're talking about basically is groupthink, because good and evil are based on groupthink. And you're living your life. If the group doesn't like the way you're living your life, you can find another group that loves the way you're living your life. So the whole thing is bogus, okay, so in my head.